You're listening to Sandy Adams Radio. Pastor Sandy is the senior pastor of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. He's currently teaching through the book of Psalms. Now, here's Pastor Sandy as he teaches through the book of Psalms, chapters 78 through 82.
Psalm 78 implores Israel to learn from both its successes and its failures. Psalm 78 begins, "Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us." It's interesting, in Matthew 13, Jesus talks about the kingdom of God by using illustrations from nature. And right in the midst of his teaching there, he quotes this psalm, Psalm 78, verses 2 and 3. "For just as Jesus was using parables from nature to communicate truth, the psalmist Asaph here is also using parables from history to convey spiritual truths." And he speaks of these truths here in verse 4. He says, "We will not hide them from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he has done." We are going to tell of these truths of what God has done. Understand, Christianity is not just a collection of metaphysical myths. It's historical fact. It's a historical faith. God invaded time and space. God has worked within history. In fact, history is nothing more than his story. And this is what our children need to know. Don't just tell your kids that God is wonderful and he's all powerful. Describe how he has put his power on display. Illustrate his power through the word and in your own life. To a child, a picture is worth a thousand words. He says, "For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children, that they may set their hope in God and not forget the words of God, but keep his commandments." The next generation of Jews should realize how instrumental God had been in their past so that they can put their faith in him in the future. He says that the generation to come might set their hope in God. This is what we want for our kids, is it not? You know, the great danger is to forget. You know, we're astonished that the Jews could ever forget the parting of the Red Sea or God bringing water from the rock. And yet we are just as guilty of forgetting God's work in our past as well. Always remember this. The devil wants us to remember the things we ought to forget and forget the things we ought to remember. We as Christians have a responsibility to bring to remembrance, to bring to our remembrance and to our children's remembrance. You know, the younger generation should recall God's work so that they are not like their fathers, he says, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not set its heart aright and whose spirit was not faithful to God. Verse 9, "The children of Ephraim," this was one of the tribes of Israel, "being armed and carrying bows, turned back in the day of battle. They did not keep the covenant of God. They refused to walk in his law and forgot his works and his wonders." Notice that, they forgot. "That he had shown them marvelous things he did in the sight of their fathers in the land of Egypt in the field of Zon." Zon was the Hebrew name for an Egyptian city called Tanis. It was the third most important Egyptian city behind Memphis and Thebes. You remember in the Raiders of the Lost Ark? You know, when they found the ark, Indiana Jones went to the city of Tanis. What does that mean with the Bible study here? Absolutely nothing, but I just thought it was interesting. But here Asaph talks about the city of Zon or Tanis. This is where God worked great plagues. He worked great wonders there in the heart of Egypt for the Hebrews. He also divided the sea and he caused them to pass through. And he made the water stand up like a heap. And I picture Charlton Heston, you know, holding up his staff, you know, over the Red Sea. And the waters peel back, and they actually stand up like heaps of wheat all along the riverbed, the ocean bed. He says, "In the daytime also, he led them with the cloud, and all the night with a light of fire." As they journeyed through the wilderness, you'll remember on their way to Mount Sinai, God's GPS was a cloud by day and a fire by night. He splits the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink in abundance like the depths. He also brought streams out of the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. God busted open rocks for his people and revealed subterranean springs that fed their thirst. God worked miracles in the desert sands for the Hebrews. And how did they respond to God? But they sinned even more against him by rebelling against the Most High in the wilderness. And they tested God in their heart by asking for the food of their fancy. The food of their fancy. That's what Rachel Ray cooks up on the food channel. The food of their, that fancy food. You know, that's the food channel stuff. Remember Israel's ingratitude. God provided a daily diet of miracle manna. You remember this? Every morning they would come out, they would wake up, and there, this wonder bread would be on the ground. They called it manna. Literally, manna means, what is it? They didn't know. We're told in Numbers 11, verse 7, that it looked like a white seed. It was kind of grainy and white. I think it was grits. But Israel, you see, hungered for tastier victuals. They wanted that food on the food channel, the leeks and onions from Egypt. They say, yes, they spoke against God. They said, can God prepare a table in the wilderness? Behold, he struck the rock so that the waters gushed out and the streams overflowed. Can he give bread also? Can he provide some meat for these people? Man, we want some chili, man. You know, we're tired of this manna all the time. We want a little meat. Where's some meat? You know, evidently God deliberately made the manna to taste bland. He didn't want Israel to fall in love with physical pleasures. Instead, he wanted his people to be spiritually oriented. You know, food is really just body fuel. God's word is the soul food. Deuteronomy 8 verse 3 says that God fed Israel manna to humble them and to teach them that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. Deuteronomy 8 verse 3. The wilderness menu was God's way of creating an appetite in his people for spiritual things, not physical things. But again, Israel failed to learn the lesson. Therefore, the Lord heard this and was furious. And so a fire was kindled against Jacob, and anger also came up against Israel because they did not believe in God and did not trust in his salvation. Yet he had commanded the clouds above and opened the doors of heaven, had rained down manna on them to eat, and given them of the bread of heaven. Men ate angels' food. He sent them food to the full. Notice the manna here is referred to as angels' food. Evidently, one of heaven's staples is manna. Manna is angelic munchies. It's a heavenly food. The angels love it. The Hebrews hated it. But Israel wanted to exchange the taste of manna. They wanted a little beef jerky, you know. Give us some beef. In verse 26, he caused an east wind to blow in the heavens. You know, be careful what you ask for. God will give it to you. Careful. He caused an east wind to blow in the heavens, and by his power he brought in the south wind, and he also rained meat on them like the dust, feathered fowl like the sand of the seas, and he let them fall in the midst of their camp all around their dwellings. God quelled their hunger with some quail. I mean, these bird game flew into the camp about 3 feet off the ground, the Old Testament tells us, about the height of a good fastball. And the people were able to just knock them down. And so they ate and were well filled, for he gave them their own desire. Oh my, be careful what you ask for. God might just give it to you. You know, God promised the Jews quail. He put it on the menu, not for one day, not for 2 days, but for a whole month they ate this meat. So much so that the Bible says it was coming out their nostrils. He gave them quail. They ate the quail until they were sick of it. And yet when the quail came, the Jews acted like bird brains. They were greedy and they grabbed it all up as if there was a limited supply. In other words, they refused to trust God And God judged them even while they were chewing the meat. Verse 30. They were not deprived of their craving, but while their food was still in their mouths, the wrath of God came against them and slew the stoutest of them and struck down the choice men of Israel. In spite of this, they still sinned, still didn't learn from their lessons, and did not believe in his wondrous works. Therefore, their days he consumed in futility and their years in fear. You know, God administers two types of judgment. There is his active judgment and there is his passive judgment. You know, God's active judgment is his direct intervention. You know, sort of like the lightning bolt from heaven. You know, somebody says something they shouldn't say and, oh, but be careful, a lightning bolt's going to come. That's God's active judgment. He can judge in that way. But there's also God's passive judgment. And this is when God just sort of turns us over to our sin. He just allows us to live in our rebellion and reap its consequences. And this is a serious, heavy judgment as well. You see, Israel not only suffered God's active judgment, but he gave them over to days of futility and years of fear. You know, at times God just leaves you in your misery. Well, verses 34 through 37 sum up Israel's painful past. He says, when he slew them, then they sought him. Isn't that a reminder? Boy, when things go wrong for us, that's when we seek God. But once things turn, we tend to forget, don't we? And they returned and they sought diligently for God. Then they remembered that God was their rock and the Most High God their Redeemer. Nevertheless, they flattered him with their mouth and they lied to him with their tongue, for their heart was not steadfast with him, nor were they faithful in his covenant. You know, they were punished for their sin, and so they would repent only to do the same sin again. You know, they were good at mouthing their allegiance, but they had no follow-through, no real heart devotion. And sadly, Israel's history was a series of broken promises. Let me ask you the question. How does your spiritual history read? You keep the promises you've made to God in the dark times when you're desperate, when, oh God, if you'll, I'll. Do you keep those promises? Or is your spiritual history a series of broken promises? Verse 38, but God, being full of compassion, forgave their iniquity and did not destroy them. Yes, many a time he turned his anger away and did not stir up all his wrath, for he remembered that they were but flesh, a breath that passes away and does not come again. And though Israel was faithless to God, God proved faithful to Israel. He got angry when Israel bucked his will, just as he gets angry with us when we do the same. But God was merciful. Notice this. He didn't stir up all his wrath. God took into account human fragility. You know, if God wanted to squish us like little bugs every time we failed, God would be a tap dancer. All we are is a warm puff of breath on a cold morning. All we are is just hot air. We're nothing but a glorified burp. That's what he says. God remembers this about us. You know, he remembers that we're just a breath passing away and does not come again. Notice, too, how verse 39 there refutes reincarnation. Man is what? A breath that passes away and does not come again. Guys, you don't get any second cracks at this life. Once you die, it's the judgment. It's appointed unto man once to die. After that, the judgment, Hebrews tells us. You know, it's been said, Israel wandered for 40 years in the wilderness because, like most men, Moses was too proud to stop and ask for directions. Well, that's supposed to be funny, but a better summation for their wanderings occurs in verse 40. How often they provoked him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. Yes, again and again they tempted God and limited the Holy One of Israel. The Hebrew word here translated limited means to scratch off. You know, since Israel chose to grumble at God rather than trust in God, the Lord scratched off blessings that he had intended to give them. Remember, the older generation died in the wilderness having never entered the promised land. And I'm sure you know the definition of the word oxymoron. It's a statement that appears contradictory, yet in reality it makes sense. I collect these oxymorons. Here are a few of my favorites. Plastic glass. Working vacation. Good grief. No grief is good. What do you mean good grief? Fresh prune. Doesn't make sense, but I guess it does. Pretty ugly. That's pretty ugly. How can anything be pretty ugly? Smart bomb. No, it's not. This is for you golfers. Metal woods. Temporary tax increase. That's an oxymoron, man. How about this one? Government organization. This is going to get me in trouble. Female logic. Just an oxymoron, man, I'm telling you. And then last but not least, my favorite, political promise. Sure. But verse 41 is the mother of all oxymorons. The Hebrews limited the Holy One of Israel. Oh, they limited the God who has no limits. They limited the unlimitable God. Why? How? By their chronic complaining. If you go back and read through the book of Numbers, you'll discover that the wilderness Hebrews had three basic complaints. They grumbled about the manna, they grumbled about Moses, and they grumbled about their mission. They didn't want to go into that land. They're giants in the land. They complained about the menu, the man of God, and the marching orders. Hey, be careful lest you grumble about the same three trifecta. You know, Israel's problem was unbelief. They didn't trust God to provide what they needed, the menu, to guide them through their leader, Moses, and to override the obstacles in their life, their mission. Guys, a critical spirit will stifle God's blessing and your effectiveness. If you want God to scratch off blessings He really wants to give you, start grumbling. Start grumbling about His provision. Start grumbling about your pastor. Start grumbling about the mission that God has called, calling in your life. Hey, be careful lest you limit the unlimitable God. Verse 42 continues. They did not remember His power, the day when He redeemed them from the enemy, when He worked His signs in Egypt and His wonders in the field of Zoan, turned their rivers into blood and their streams that they could not drink. He's recounting here the 10 plagues. He sent swarms of flies among them which devoured them and frogs which destroyed them. He also gave their crops to the caterpillar and their labor to the locust. He destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamore trees with frost. He also gave up their cattle to the hail and their flocks to fiery lightning. He cast on them the fierceness of His anger, wrath, indignation, and trouble by sending angels of destruction among them. He made a path for His anger. He did not spare their soul from death, but gave their life over to the plague and destroyed all the firstborn in Egypt. That was the final plague, the first of their strength in the tents of Ham. Ham, by the way, was Noah's son who actually settled in Africa. In fact, if you'll go back to Genesis 10, it charts the descendants of Ham. And one of his sons was named Mizraim, which is the biblical name for Egypt. He goes on, he says, but He made His own people go forth like sheep and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. And He led them on safely so that they did not fear, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies. And He brought them to His holy border, this mountain which His right hand had acquired. He also drove out the nations before them, allotted them an inheritance by survey, and made the tribes of Israel dwell in their tents. He's just helping them remember their history. Yet they tested and provoked the Most High God and did not keep His testimonies, but turned back and acted unfaithfully like their fathers. They were turned aside like a deceitful bow. In other words, they didn't shoot straight. They weren't straight shooters. For they provoked Him to anger with their high places and moved Him to jealousy with their carved images. You know, the high places were these unsanctioned places of worship. And they invariably either led to idolatry or they were prompted by idolatry. They were never a good thing. He says, when God heard this, He was furious and greatly abhorred Israel, so that He forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent He had placed among men, and delivered his strength into captivity and his glory into the enemy's hand. 1 Samuel chapter 4 tells us about the Philistines' defeat of Israel. Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of the high priest Eli, they actually took the Ark of the Covenant into battle there at Aphek. In other words, they trusted in the things of God rather than in God himself. A lot of people do that. Oh, I'm okay. I go to church. Well, you know, I sing in the choir. Oh, I give my money. People can trust in the things of God rather than trust in God himself. And what happened to the Hebrews when they took the ark into battle? The Philistines defeated them, and the ark fell into enemy hands. In addition, the tabernacle was razed to the ground. It was a truly dark day in the history of Israel. He also gave his people over to the sword and was furious with his inheritance. The fire consumed their young men, and their maidens were not given in marriage. Their priests fell by the sword, and their widows made no lamentation. Israel suffered a crushing defeat. Then, that's a good word, then. For 20 years later, Samuel led the nation in the Battle of Mizpah, and he beat back the Philistine hordes, and he liberated Israel. You know, by the way, it happened suddenly and spontaneously. We're told, then the Lord awoke as from sleep. Now, this is obviously a metaphor, for Psalm 121, verse 4 reads, "He who keeps Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep." God doesn't have a body that needs to rest or needs to go to sleep. God never shuts his eyes or loses consciousness. Yet at the Battle of Mizpah, it was as if God said, enough is enough. You know, like you, when you suddenly wake out of sleep, you know, your wife hits you. Did you hear that, honey? And you spring out of bed, you know. Where is it? Where is it? You know, there's a spontaneous initiation of power. This is what happened at the Battle of Mizpah. It was as if God said, enough is enough. And he sprang like a man who suddenly awakes. He gives another metaphor. Like a mighty man who shouts because of wine. Now, here's some bizarre imagery. I'll bet you didn't know that the Bible depicts God as a drunk soldier. That's the picture he gives here. And let me suggest that a soldier with a gun, under the influence of alcohol, he's got no fear and he knows no cautiousness. He's ready for action. Get a little alcohol under your belt, get a gun in your hand, you're a soldier, you're used to shooting people. I mean, you get all that combination together, you got no reservations. You're ready for action. That's what he's saying about God. It was that kind of abandon that God used to defeat the Philistines. He says, and he beat back his enemies. He put them to a perpetual reproach. Verse 67, moreover, he rejected the tent of Joseph and did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved. You know, during the period of the judges, Ephraim was the leading tribe in Israel. Joshua had been from the family of Joseph and from his son Ephraim. But when the ark was returned to Israel, it was no longer housed in Shiloh within Ephraim, but it was housed in Judah. David would eventually bring the ark up to his new capital, Jerusalem, which was in the tribe of Judah. And he built his sanctuary like the heights, like the earth, which he has established forever. The sanctuary he's talking about here was King Solomon's temple that was built again in Jerusalem, in Judah. And he also chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. Notice this, he calls David his servant. You'll recall David was a king, he was a warrior, he was a general, he was a musician, he wrote many of the Psalms, and he was a prophet. But most importantly, his most important job was that of God's servant.
Every emotion you can think of is found in the book of Psalms. From exuberant praise to devastating despair and everything in between. The authors of these beautiful songs poured their hearts out to God. They sang because of sorrow and because of gratitude in the middle of terror and at the end of trials. Their words are recorded to aid our own expressions of emotion and remind us to ultimately turn to God, no matter the circumstances. We're glad you tuned in today to Sandy Adams Radio to join us in this examination of the Book of Psalms. We'd love to hear how God has been using His Word in your own life. So please take a moment to connect with us. You can call us at 770-736-2828. Again, that's 770-736-2828. If you want to hear today's teaching again or perhaps share it with someone you feel needs to hear it, let us know when you call. Just mention today's date and we'll send you a CD with the message in its entirety. We've also archived many of Pastor Sandy's messages at sandyadams.org. Just click on Sermons in the menu or scroll down the page to find a list of all the books of the Bible Pastor Sandy has shared messages from. You can even read Pastor Sandy's teaching notes. That's all for today, but join us next time for another edition of Sandy Adams Radio.